72 holes, one epic cause. Cancer Council's The Longest Day is the ultimate golf challenge. Four rounds of golf in one day to support people impacted by cancer. Have you got what it takes? Register now at thelongestday.org.au and get ready to tee off for a cancer-free future. Hello and welcome to The Thing About Golf, the podcast series from Golf Australia magazine, exploring the countless reasons people get hooked on this absurd game. Rod Morrie's my name, and it's fitting that on this final episode of 2023, we're going to meet the undisputed best-performed golfer of the year, man, woman, or junior. No, it's not a professional from one of the big circuits or even a rising young star of the game. It's way more intriguing than that. Nadine Goll is 55 years old and a former touring professional who didn't touch a club for 20 years. But Nadine is now, after a genuinely mind-boggling 2023, the number one ranked senior women's amateur golfer in the world. Goll achieved something this past 12 months that has not only not ever been done before, but is unlikely to ever be done again. In 15 tournament starts, she won 9 times. Among those 9 wins were all 6 Australian state titles, plus the national championship. For good measure, she also threw in the New Zealand senior women's amateur and the Scottish senior stroke play. It's difficult to recall a player having a season like that at any level of the game, and yet the fanfare is disappointingly quiet. That response is among a myriad of topics Nadine talks about in this wide-ranging discussion that even occasionally wanders into golf. Well, we'll start this episode, as we always do, by saying the same thing, which is thank you for taking part, Nadine Goll. It's a commitment to do The Thing About Golf, and we do appreciate you sitting down for it. It is our jumping-off point. The clue's in the title. What's the thing about golf for Nadine Goll?
Oh, gosh, the thing about golf.
Never thought about it, have you?
Well, I think it brings a lot of joy. It's a lot of fun and mentally challenging.
Well, that's been fantastic. Lovely to chat to you. Nailed it there. Of course, it has been a very big part of your life. For those who don't realise, let me quickly run through Nadine's record for this past 12 months as a senior amateur. 15 starts, 9 wins, 3 seconds. What were you doing for the other 3 tournaments? That's 12.
I probably have my feet up.
Win and second. Yeah, what are you doing? You're taking it easy. You've won all 6 state senior amateur titles and the national senior amateur title in 1 year. Never been done before, we're sure of it. It's a pretty staggering thing. Nadine Goll, who are you? Why do golfers not know you? And how have you achieved this extraordinary goal?
Well, I don't know if they don't know me, but I'd say probably because I had a 20-year hiatus. That could have had something to do with it.
We don't know you the way we know Kari Webb, for example.
Well, it's very hard to get into Kari.
It's very hard to get into that esteemed company. But you know what I mean. It's
I guess maybe, as I just said, having that hiatus from golf, having had a family, and seniors golf is what it is. I guess people are just starting to get a better understanding of it, I think.
Senior amateur golf, too. Even senior professional golf doesn't attract anywhere near the attention that we see at the top ends of the game. The Champions Tour doesn't get the same sort of coverage as the PGA Tour or the Korn Ferry Tour. And so is that ageist? I know you did a podcast recently on ageism. Is that ageist? Are we in the media guilty of something there as well?
I'm not going to blame the media, but as I would say to anyone, we, at my age, which feels like 25, even though it's 55, I don't feel any different, but I think many more people at this age are taking golf up. Mm-hmm. And the majority of the population playing golf would be 55 and above. So I'm not sure why it's not being followed, or maybe why you haven't heard of me. I don't know.
It's an interesting. Well, you've got two things going on, haven't you, Nadine? Not only have you had the temerity to be old, quote unquote, but you're also a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like if you're left-handed, that would be quite the trifecta of minorities, wouldn't it?
Wow, I'd be never heard of then, would I?
How do you feel about that? In all honesty, what I've read out there, and I don't care what level you play at, that's an extraordinary achievement to win all 6 state amateur titles and the national title. Aside from, I think you also won in New Zealand. You've had other wins as well along the way, and in Scotland, the world's number one ranked senior women's amateur. Mm-hmm. Leaving aside the discussion about where that should fit and what sort of attention that should get, how does that make you sort of feel? Because,
Rod, I've only just stopped playing last Thursday.
Mm-hmm. You see, your hand has got a bandage on it.
I had my surgery on Monday, and it's only just walking up here because obviously I'm not driving a car at the moment, and I have just looked at that this morning and thought, wow, because I honestly have just played golf. I say this, I try to do the best I can every time I go out and play. It's not my everything because I still work. It's just been an amazing year. It's all I can say, and it's been a lot of fun. It's been a huge challenge, and there have been a lot of people that have enabled me to do it as well.
We'll come back to some of that. Mm-hmm. Is that perhaps the key, what you said at the start there? I just went out to play golf.
I did just go out to play golf.
Has that always been the case? We'll talk about your past, and you were a professional way back in the 90s and some other things, but has that always been the case during your golf
career? Not necessarily. I think I've had a big mind shift in the last 12 months. It's my time in life, and our children are, 25 and 22. It was more that last year a friend of mine from Huntingdale, Heather Gately, said, "Had you thought about playing seniors golf?" And it was not on my radar. And I came back in 2020 to start playing at the club, at the Victoria Golf Club Pennant, and then I went on to win the championship there. And then when it was mentioned to me, I said to Sam, "What is this seniors golf?" And he looked into it, and it ended me, and I said, "Oh, God, I don't think I'm ready to play competitive golf." So I went out and played a couple, and I was not prepared because I hadn't had my golf clubs looked at. I really hadn't done a lot of preparation golf-wise. And like everything I do, Ron, I give it 100% in so many areas. So I got to January. I sat down with Sam, and I sat down with Andrew Cooper, my golf coach, and I said, "This is where I want to be." And I put a strategy and a lot of preparation as to what I'd like to do. And regardless of what has eventuated, I would always give it 100%. And if that was what my best was, and that's what it was when I went to the States, it would be interesting to see how I play there. And I thought, well, I'll have a go. And I'm all about having a go. So that has probably been... it's very simple, but my attitude towards what I do, the acceptance of things nowadays are very different to when I was younger.
So there's a whole life happened. Let's back up. I mentioned there you were a professional, played on the Ladies European Tour in the mid-90s, I'm going to say. Tell us about
1990 through to 1997.
Okay. So give us a bit of a thumbnail sketch of your golf history. Where did it start for you? You didn't take it up in 1990 when you joined the tour, obviously. Golf came into your life earlier than that.
No, I started when I was 13 at Tarogan Golf Club. So I was brought up in Gippsland and quickly came in and started playing state golf at 15.
So it was pretty obvious pretty early you had a knack for the game. You had talent.
Look, it was something that Mum and Dad never really wanted me to play. My sister and I were brought up to play team sport. So, we were playing every other sport possible. And you did mention Peter Senior in our cup of tea time, and that was that he stayed with Mum and Dad when we had a pro-am there.
Wow.
And Pete had said to Mum and Dad, can the girls come and caddy? And Stephen Bam was staying with us as well. So my sister caddied for Steve and I caddied for Pete, and he sort of said to me, "Do you want to hit some shots?"
Wow.
And I'd never really hit any shots. And he sort of said to Mum, I think Nadine might be able to play some golf. Anyway, being brought up in the country was very easy because the freedom access, get out and hit golf balls in a paddock, wherever you wanted to.
It's kind of safe too, isn't it?
Very safe.
You don't want your kids wandering down to the golf course in the city necessarily.
No. So that's where it started. And then, like a lot of juniors who are very keen on their sport, I then became in the Australian squad and played for Australia when I was 18. I then became a professional at the age of 21. So maybe it was a bit too soon. I don't know. But my first event, which was the Vic Open at Commonwealth, I lost in a playoff to Sue Tonkin. And from there, I played the Asian Tour, Europe, and a little bit of time in Japan.
That's a hard slog. We'll come back to that. What was it like caddying for Peter Senior? That's a hell of an introduction to golf, to see that up close.
Well, the
what
thing
a
is,
player he is and has been.
Oh, what an amazing player. But for me, because I was only 12 going on 13, I probably didn't understand the enormity of it. No.
Oh, you know, that's what golf looks like. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll
just
pull the bag.
You hit it out of the middle and hit it next to the flag and putt it in, and how hard can it be?
It was probably, you know, keep up and shut up, you know.
Indeed.
I just think I carried the bag, and he would have just taken his club out, and I just would have watched. And you know, and from time on from there, we would see him at, you know, Kingston Heath when the Australian Open, and Mum and Dad would always follow him. So we always kept that contact up.
Interesting that, and it's just a bit of a rabbit hole, we talked about ageism. He won the Australian Masters at the age of 56. In fact, he won all three of Australia's biggest men's tournaments after the age of 50, the Open, the PGA, and the Australian Masters. And when he won that Australian Masters, he talked about hoping that other people in their 50s would understand themselves, life's not over because you're older. He beat all those flat bellies. Adam Scott was in that field. And a lot of other very good young players, Michael Sim and Peter Senior, outplayed all of them at the age of 56. One of the more extraordinary sporting feats in Australia, I think, in that sense. So it's ironic that it was him. So when you went on to play professional golf, even today, things are much better for women who want to pursue a professional career, which is not to say they're great, but they're much better. What was it like? What were the prospects back then? When you sat down and said, I'm going to turn professional, what were the opportunities in front of you, realistically?
Well, I don't know that there were opportunities because you had to create your own. And I recently had a conversation with Brett Ogle about that. You know, in the 90s, going to Europe, I didn't have to qualify, but I had, you know, probably six top tens that year. It was the cost of living that was the main expense, and it was hard to weigh up. Because then the events started to fall over, particularly from 92 through to 94. And there was obviously a recession there, as you know. And it was difficult to get any continuity because we weren't playing enough golf. So a whole year of golf, there could have, you know, there may have only been like 12 or 15 events. But then to stay over there for such a long time and not having anywhere to stay or...
Where were you living? What, England or...?
I was staying in England, but I was staying in a B&B because I didn't have any contacts for someone to just, you know...
Yeah, that's an expensive way to live, isn't
it? Billet or anything like that. So it became very expensive. And then it plays on you're not playing as often and then, you know, you start thinking about the money and it just became very messy. I then decided I wanted to play in Japan. So I went through the qualifying school there and lasted a year or so and then went back to Europe, whereby I was given an exemption to one event and the person running the event said to me, look, if you finish first or second, you'll probably imagine saying that. If you win or come second, you can probably get a few more events. Well, I went on to win the event, which was the Danish Open, and I then had an exemption for a few years.
Was Japan – Japan's an interesting place for golf, particularly for women's golf, I think. Women's golf in Japan is bigger than men's golf as a spectator sport. They have more tournaments on TV. But it's a culturally very different place. What was it like when you played there? My understanding is now you need to take an interpreter with you everywhere you go at your own expense on the Japanese tour. Was that the case back then?
Yes. I did have an interpreter to do most of my things, but I did try and teach myself Japanese. I wish that I'd stayed in Japan longer. I love Japan. To me, the tour there is amazing. They don't – I don't want to say this in a negative way, but they're not necessarily wanting foreigners there. But the tour itself is extremely exposed. It's televised. The spectators, I mean, they want you to sign everything. I mean, one of the events, I was coming like fifth at one point on the Sunday, and it was 6-10 deep around the first tee. So it's a very followed sport. It's very popular. I mean, they've got soccer, baseball, whatever, but the sponsorship is there. And I do know, you know, Marnie McGuire and Jenny Sewell, there are a couple of others that went there, had very successful careers there.
Yeah. What do you think that is? We see it in both Japan and South Korea, where women's golf in particular is a hugely popular sport, and probably even more so in South Korea.
Well, I was fortunate enough to go over with Kari in 96. There's a couple of other of us. We went to South Korea and we played a couple of events there. And that was the start of golf in South Korea. I went there 96, 97 before I retired. and they were making waves then.
Just before the Sayre Pack boom.
Yeah, absolutely.
She drove an extraordinary boom, which we still see the results of today on the LPGA.
Well, there again, they've got a lot of sponsorship.
What do you think it is, though? We have decent support, I think, for the few women's events that we've had here in Australia. We went to a couple of Australian Women's Opens in Adelaide, and they were fantastic events. Amazing fields, LPGA fields. But nothing like what we see out of South Korea. What do you think it is maybe culturally in South Korea and Japan? Have you ever had a think about that? And why don't we see the same sort of support for women's golf outside those two countries?
It's a really interesting question because I've probably not really thought about it. And my
They stand out, don't they?
The thing
they
is, really stand I think what it is that the sponsorship, they believe in the product.
Right.
So they're looking at a product which is, wow, she's a good golfer, and the product and the sponsors are external to the sport.
So they feed each other.
They feed each other. So they look out. It doesn't have to be a golf brand to be associated with it. I mean, you know, like anything, if you go through Japan and you see someone on the train and they're wearing, whether it be Kubota or whatever the brand is, people then start to associate it to the golf. So it's interesting that the sponsors have been smart enough to align themselves with the sports person rather than it being the other way around that we must always align ourselves with a golf product.
Yeah.
Maybe there's more, I don't know if there's more respect, but I do know that when you are in Japan and in South Korea, the respect that is given to a female sports person is, well, it's just different.
Yeah.
There's a lot of respect there.
Yeah. Mm. It'd be lovely if we could bottle that and take it to the rest of the world. So I think there's a disappointing lack of respect within golf broadly, I think, for women in particular, women's golf in particular, which is not to say it's uniform, I think, and it's much better than it used to be. The product is phenomenal. It just doesn't get the attention that it deserves.
I'd agree. And, you know, the interesting thing here, Rod, and I've mentioned to you, I did another podcast external to golf a couple of months ago.
You can see other podcasts. I'm okay with that.
We're golf here. But the wonderful thing about that is that it's come – I've got people now interested. Like I've just spoken to you about Korea and Japan and females being brought in with sponsors out external to the sport. People have thought, oh, wow, I wouldn't mind being associated with someone like that. That'd be great for our brand. And, you know, I think that I'm an inspiration to a lot of people. Like you say with Peter Senior, I think I bring a lot to a lot of companies. So I think if people start to embrace that, then we or myself will start to promote the sport. It's probably going to do the opposite. It's probably the opposite to how we think.
Yeah, I was just about to say, have you broken the cardinal golf rule there, Nadine? Are you thinking outside the box?
Well, it's taken me 55 years.
We don't do particularly well at it, do we? Australia has two women's golf major winners currently playing the LPGA Tour, three women's majors to Australia's name in the last 5 years, and yet we still struggle in terms of sort of sponsorship and recognition for women's golf in this country. And Kari Webb is one of the LPGA's great players, and possibly you could make the case that she's Australia's best player.
You're not going to be able to argue with me there. She is.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
Hannah and Minji are just amazing. And Steph, I mean, there are some amazing.
They're the major ones. And you've got Grace Kim's already a winner on the tour. Steph Kiriakou is going to win at some point on the LPGA, an extraordinary talent. There's a lot of.
And even Sarah Kemp, you know.
Playing some of the best golf of her career the last couple of years.
Absolutely. Hmm. So.
Adam Scott wins one Masters, and look at all the attention he gets. You're not biting for that, are you? You're not going to get involved in that. Who doesn't love Adam Scott?
Well, I love Adam. And I mean, how marketable is he? But yeah. I think what we need to do is find a way how we can market.
If Adam Scott had Greg Norman's mouth, he would be Tiger Woods. He's the complete package.
He is. People would say he's an absolute gentleman.
Yeah, and he truly is. But possibly in terms of marketing, to his own detriment. You know, if he was a little more controversial occasionally, it might have helped him along in that space. So when you were playing sort of on the tour and whatnot, what was the difference then? You've clearly got quite the gift for the game. This last 12 months proves it. And nobody's going to suggest that senior women's amateur golf globally is as competitive as perhaps the LET and the Japan Tour was back in those days. But Something's clearly happened in between there, Nadine. Did you completely give up golf when you stopped playing professionally?
I did.
Completely. Was that a difficult decision?
Look, I think it just happened. I remember when Sam said, oh, look, well, you know, you'll have Ben and then, you know, we'll go back and you'll play on the, you'll play the Open, you'll play the European Masters. And when you're breastfeeding, it's not that easy. And I just decided that I wanted to, we wanted to put our energy into our children. So, you know, we both juggled our jobs so that we could bring both Ben and Sophie up.
Did you miss it?
I didn't have time to think about it or miss it because I wasn't thinking about it. Mm. I was coaching part-time and it probably wasn't till probably, you know, 5 or 6 years ago I said to Sam, I really want to get back and play some golf, and that's why I took my membership up at the Victoria Golf Club that had been sitting there for years.
And so then, you never completely broke away. You had the membership there. You just didn't use it.
I never used it. I never took it up. It'd been sitting there from 97. So, you know, I guess I was giving my energy to other things, like I was helping people get better at their golf. I'd take golf travel. I would teach golf. I would work in golf retail.
Anything but play it seems like, Nadine.
That's it.
Was there anything about that, and I spoke to Jane Locke about this, and she gets frustrated that she can't do the things she used to do, and sometimes she's not inspired to play golf for that reason. Was there an element of that for you, that if you couldn't play it properly in terms of a professional and dedicate all your time to practicing and being prepared, that you didn't want to play at all?
No, but then I'm going to tap into this with you because I think I'm a better golfer now than I was then.
It's going to be one of my questions at some point, so you've
and,
done well.
How
can that be? There is not any sport in the world, is there, where at the age of 55 you can be better than when you were 25, surely?
Well, I think I've nearly proved it wrong. Mm-hmm. Your question to me was, remind me again, before I jumped into that.
Did you not want to play because you didn't feel you could give it 100%? So if you couldn't give it 100%, you'd rather not play. You'd be involved in the game but not play.
No, I never probably had that because the thing for me, my mind and my energy was into something else. As I said,
you're giving
different
that
business, 100%. Absolutely. And I was doing some real estate, so there was no golf on the radar. But when I made the decision at the beginning of this year, I knew that there was a lot left in that tank that just was very untapped.
So how can you explain to me, I think it's a unique thing about golf, and I think you're right, it's possible. How can you possibly be a better player at 55 than 25? You said you're a better golfer now. What does that mean? Do you hit it better? Do you putt better? Do you think better? All of the
above?
I think
better. I probably hit it better. I've done a lot.
Equipment's changed too.
Equipment's changed, but also I think I've been fortunate that my body is in pretty good shape. And I've done a lot of work with Andrew Cooper, who's at Victoria Golf Club, and the things that he's been able to get me to do. Like, you know, a few months ago, Sam's been there the whole time, my husband.
Sam's your husband, sorry.
Yeah, Sam. And he has been instrumental in me getting to where I am. But he stands there and says, I've never seen you hit shots like that. I've never seen you hit it that high. So there's things that Andrew has – I've got a better understanding of me and my body and what I can do. So, you know, I'll stand there and I think, oh, yeah, I can hit that over that trap and hit it and stop it. And there are not many women whom I'm playing with that probably can hit it up with that flight and stop it. So it's been relearning some things and learning some new things. Mm-hmm. I've loved it.
What was teaching and coaching like in the 90s when you played versus today? And then we'll come to equipment and where the differences might be as well.
Oh, that's a really good question.
Were you one that had a coach when you were touring pro?
For very little of my time. I did make some changes, but I wasn't in a position to be able to have that person with me.
Coaches aren't cheap, are they? Especially if you want to take them around the world with you.
Yeah, and so that never happened. And so when I would be at home, I would see someone and then, you know, I'd go away for 6 months and not see them. So it was never an ideal situation. And I guess now with technology, it's so much easier. I'm on a practice fair in Arizona and we get Andrew on the phone and he just looks at one swing, he goes, do this, and I'm like, bang, and then we're off. So technology has really enabled, I think, coaches and players to not actually be near each other, but be able to still be productive.
Especially when you come from Australia. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. That Cam Smith can dial up Grant Field from anywhere in the world is that's an advantage that wasn't afforded, say, Greg Norman in the 80s or
the 90s. Absolutely. Yeah, that's
it. He couldn't do that had he wanted to. So, yeah. And what about equipment? The equipment we used to play the game. You would have seen some jokes. The 90s was the last of the Ballada ball, predominantly blade irons.
Yeah.
The hybrid was a very new idea, if it was an idea at all. Did you carry a 2-iron when you played on the tour?
Absolutely.
Back then, could you hit it?
Well, when they had the bumpy fairways, it was great.
Yeah. Talk about some of those things that you, because it's an interesting perspective to have been in the game at that level, then not play at all, be around the game, but not play at all. Mm-hmm. And then come back. Just the sound of the contact between club and ball must have been confronting for you at first.
Well, I guess I think in the 90s, you know, when I was retiring out of the game, it's when Seven Woods and things like that came out. And I remember watching Annika hit it out of the rough. You know, we'd be trying to get 3-iron out of there. Because we couldn't get out of the rough, we'd have to try and hit 7-iron. So then I guess being out of the game, I hadn't noticed how much technology had changed. You know, the drive is bigger. I've gone into much lighter shafts. I've got a better understanding of my equipment.
You've probably been fitted for your equipment in a way that you never would have been even as a touring professional in the 90s.
And even though I've been fitted, I've challenged it and I've said, well, hang on, that doesn't feel right, or this is what feels good for me and that's not flying as far. It's not. So I've been able to be far more involved in that. And, you know, Tour Edge have been amazing in Australia. I've loved the golf clubs. I've had 3 sets this year. And
how do you let go of a winning set of golf clubs? You've won so much. How can you let go of any of them?
Well, they've all won, so it doesn't matter.
That's okay. It's all evened out in the end. How much could you have won if you'd stuck with the first set? No, I'm kidding.
Look, I mean, it's just exciting, Ron. It really is. I'm like a kid in a candy shop, aren't I?
Yeah, well, you are, and which is fantastic to see. And you talked about sort of inspiration, and you mentioned that lots of people, I find this particularly with my work, is that you come across people who for their whole lives have believed that golf is for old people. And they've played other sports, proper sports, tennis and cricket and football and soccer and hockey. And one day their shoulders and their knees and their hips say to them, no more hockey. So they have to find a competitive outlet. So they come to golf. And almost to a person, they say, gee, I wish I'd done this 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
How do we get that message across to the 25-year-old group of people who are going to come to us at 55 with broken knees and say, gee, I wish I'd discovered this 30 years ago? Why doesn't golf get that message across? And it's one of golf's biggest problems is its image.
Well, you know, we have a son who's 25 and, you know, he doesn't really want to go to a golf course with a collar and you know, dress up for golf, but he loves golf now.
Have a crack at Oakley where they don't have any of that sort of stuff and get to it before they close it too, because apparently it'll be better used if it's a park than a golf course.
Well, like everything, we need public golf courses, don't we? We need public and private, but we need public access. There's no doubt about it.
Memo, if you're a private golf course, you really want to campaign for public golf because that's where all your members come from. So if they close those down, that tap is going to get turned off.
Look, you know, it's interesting you talk about that. You know, as I said, I took up golf at 13 and I went to a girls' school and, you know, it was for old people. I didn't really talk about that. I played golf on the weekend. You know, I'd have netball on Saturday and Sunday I'd sneak off to golf and it was for old people. And my school backed on to the 13th of the Tarragon Golf Course and I'd see Mum out there playing. And it was very difficult because I became... It's an addictive sport.
Oh, absolutely.
And people think, oh, you just walk around. But it's no different to probably someone smashing a tennis ball and getting it out of the middle of the racket.
It's much different.
And it's just the endorphins and the adrenaline that come from hitting a great golf shot. Well, I'd say holding a putt's even better, but people just think of it as being slow. Mm-hmm. And it's not that. It's about the moment of that shot and moving on, and then you still get to have that social side of it. So in many ways, I say if there's no better sport because you can be any age, mm-hmm. you can be any gender, and you, even if you do have an injury, you can still play golf. Mm-hmm. I'm fortunate to be 55 playing golf again. I love it. And I just hope many more people take it up. I meet a lot of people say, I've just taken up golf. And I think maybe for women it might be their careers. It could be having children that stop them from playing golf. but
perceived expense. It's nowhere near as expensive as people. It doesn't need to be anywhere near as expensive as people think it is. Here's the problem with tennis, to go down a rabbit hole. You hit the ball and then someone hits it back. Seems kind of dumb, doesn't it?
Well, you've got to have someone to play it with
first. That's right. Yeah, so that's the first problem. But then if they're going to hit it back, what was the point of hitting it there in the first place? At least with golf, you get to hit it into all sorts of interesting places and go find it and hit it again. So that's the anti-tennis argument.
Yes. You need another person. And the positive golf is you always have a different surround, whereas tennis is the same dimensions.
The overlooked part of golf in terms of exercise, I think, is the mental exercise. I'm not sure if it's ever been done, but what do you reckon would be the average set of calculations you do over every single golf shot that you face? In all seriousness.
Gosh. And then I've got Sam there doing it as well.
Exactly. So you've got some visual artistic elements of you need to see some sort of a shot. You've then got to do some mathematical calculation about how far that goes. Mm-hmm. You've got to have some internal knowledge of how far each club goes. You've got to then factor in wind, mm-hmm. elevation, lie. There's a lot going on mentally in golf, which is probably why people think it's boring on television. They don't understand those elements. People who are golfers and watch golf, they're doing all the same things as the player is.
Yeah, true.
But it doesn't look like anybody's doing it because it's all thinking stuff. We don't promote that part of golf, do we, about how active it keeps the brain?
Well, it does, because even the day before you may have played a certain way and evaluated that and said, you know, I'd do it differently. So you've done like a post game, and not for long, in preparation for the next day. So I'd never looked at it that way, but there is a lot going on upstairs.
An awful lot. An awful lot. And physically too. We underrate the benefits of the physical movement of golf, the swing itself. The walking is good, but the swing itself does all sorts of wonderful things for balance, particularly for older people. When you start to take away public golf, you take away from a demographic that needs it much more than the demographic that you're giving the park to.
Yes.
In that sense, if you sense that I'm campaigning for Oakley Golf Course at every opportunity, you might, and Moore Park in Sydney,
yes,
for all sorts of reasons, that would be right. Calling all golf legends, let's tee off for a cancer-free future this December. Cancer Council's The Longest Day is the ultimate golf challenge, where you'll play four rounds of golf in one day to support people impacted by cancer. Almost one in two Australians will be diagnosed with cancer before the age of 85. By working together, we can all play a part in reducing the impact of cancer for all Australians. Have you got what it takes? Grab your mates and register now at thelongestday.org.au and let's tackle cancer together. This mental change that you've talked about, this difference in attitude, is it a life thing? Is it life experience that's brought this? Or is it a golf thing, where 20 years away from the game has allowed you to view it differently?
It's a life thing. It's a new me.
Yeah. Two kids and running a business, and that's a lot of things going on all the time.
I just think, Rod, I'm enjoying life. I'm enjoying who I am. I'm being kind to myself. I love what I do, and it's really flowing through into my golf.
Were you kind to yourself as a golfer when you were younger?
No, too hard on myself.
The temptation is to berate oneself constantly.
I have no idea why, because it doesn't actually achieve anything. So, you know, and I still do a lot of self-talk now. I just always try to find the positive in something.
I read something very interesting about golf psychology in that sense one day, and it was quite simply, if you are talking to yourself and you're saying things that you would never say to another person, you need to think about the things that you're saying to yourself. And every golfer out there will be nodding furiously as you just were, because we've all done it, haven't we?
Absolutely.
It's the easiest thing in the world to do. I'm an idiot. How could you do that? You did that yesterday and it was easy and now you can't do it because there's something wrong with you. I wonder where that comes from sometimes. I feel like, I don't know, I don't play any other sports. I wonder whether that's true in other sports as well. Do footballers have those self-talks?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Mm.
But it is interesting. Like, why would you? Like, why would you talk to yourself like that?
Yeah.
What does it achieve?
And how often do you tell yourself, great shot? Do we take the time to enjoy our best stuff?
Well, I am now, let me tell you.
And look at the results. And I mean that in all seriousness. Mm. Have you consciously noticed that positive self-talk or positive, which doesn't matter. We don't like that in Australia, do we? We're not big on people who will tell you how good they are or what a great shot they just hit. Mm. But if you just tell yourself that, does it work?
It does. But you know what I've been loving is when someone comes up to me and say, how the hell did you just play that shot? Mm-hmm. And I look, and they've been a professional golfer. And I think, wow, if that – I know internally how I feel, and if it impresses them, then I'm going to say, well, I'm going to play some more of those shots.
Yeah.
And as I said to you before, why not have a go?
Yeah.
You know,
well, you might fail. So,
there's two options. You know, I could have a go, and it might come off. But if I don't have a go, I'll never know, will I? So, why not always have a go?
Is that a difficult? You're not playing professional golf now, but professionally, those things are difficult, aren't they? Because I can't remember who I spoke to this about one day, but when they were retired, it might have been Peter Fowler. When he was a teenager, it was great fun to go out onto the 15th hole of their course and see who could hit driver off the deck over the water and hold the green. And that was play and it was wonderful. Everybody enjoyed it immensely. Mm. And he said, I would never consider that shot in a professional golf tournament.
Mm.
There's no room for fun when it's business, or there's less room for fun.
Yeah, perhaps. But you know, even now, even though it's not for money, I still have to score. Mm-hmm. So it's still the same because.
Would it be different if it was for money?
Well, I'd probably do it more so now because there is something at the end for it. But what about if you believe in what you're doing and that you can do it? So I was on Sunday, I had my last game of golf, I think, for a while, and I was with my sponsor and I hit this shot at Vic and he said, would you have done that in a tournament? I said, well, I wouldn't have had any other option. And it was a pretty amazing shot at the time. And I said, yes, I would have. Because I know I can do it. So I think the thing is, Andrew has really stretched me into a lot of different shots. I'm not very one-dimensional or anything like that. So, I mean, what's the option? It might go over the green. It might go in the bunker. It might go near the hole. And The last one, I think it might actually go close to the hole. So that's a mindset, isn't it?
It sounds like a freedom that you're describing.
It's absolutely a freedom.
That's more difficult than you're making it sound for most of us, though, isn't it? I've always thought that golf could reasonably change its name to easier said than done. Mm. Everything about golf feels easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about golf that seems the most sensible thing seems to be the most difficult thing to actually do. It's such a game of opposites, isn't it, mentally?
It is, because you're challenging yourself mentally. And if you've got that slight amount of doubt, and I spoke to Carrie Webb about it once, you know, you've got this devil and the angel, and I think you've got to get into this space of what you'd like to do rather than what you don't want to do. And I did a lot of psychology on that. People would always look at what they didn't want to do rather than what they wanted to do, whether it be golf or anything. And, you know, you're driving a car and you're going to hit into the back of the car, or you're going to turn left and miss it. I mean, there's just so many analogies and similarities in life. And I think maybe I've just found us all of a sudden it's taken this long of where I actually want to be.
So does it work in reverse? You said that sort of life's happened and that's helped your golf. Mm-hmm. Has your extraordinarily successful past 12 months in golf flowed over into other areas of life? Is there a reverse thing that happens as well?
My friends have seen a different me. Business, all sorts of things, you know.
Are they tangible things, or are they hard to put your finger on, but things are just different?
I'm more at peace. I'm enjoying life and people around me. Just everything I do, I just have a completely different attitude towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of acceptance in things as well.
It's all sounding a bit hippie and woke, Nadine. Aren't we too grown up for that?
Well, someone said to me, I still haven't grown up. I'm happy not to grow up. I can't really put my finger on it. I mean, I just think I've reprogrammed myself. I've just started to enjoy things. Rob, that's probably what it is.
Yeah. It's probably, it'd be a very short book, but it'd be a very helpful book for a lot of people, wouldn't it?
Well, someone asked me to write a book the other day. I could be pretty long. I have plenty of adversity in my life, so, you know.
Well, talk about that, and how does that fit into golf and where you are now? Nobody gets through life without it, do they? Nobody.
Not that I know of.
No. Even the people we look at and think they've got the perfect life, they don't. Nobody does.
Look, I've never really had dwelled on you know, the things that happened to me in my past. And
let's do it now.
Well, I mean, they didn't mean anything because I was so young. But they, when I look through life, I think they probably had impacted some of the way I was perceived, or maybe some of my behaviours. But, you know, I think, you know, with my hearing, I think...
So you can't hear me in your right ear, can you? You've got headphones on, but we could take one of them off and you would make a difference.
I wouldn't hear a thing. Mm. And
what happened there? What was that about?
We still don't know. Mum and Dad believe I was born that way, but we still don't know. And I'm not able to have cochlear or hearing aids or anything. So
just completely deaf in the right ear. It just doesn't work at all.
Doesn't work. And when I was 47, I went and had more tests. I just got one very deaf ear. And I think there's a lot of things I haven't heard. I think a lot of people misinterpreted me because I didn't hear anything, or they might have thought I'd snobbed them.
There's an awkwardness that my mum had a brain tumour. She only has one. It happened to her later in life. She was about 55 when it happened, ironically. And so she has no hearing at all in one ear. And she's found life very, very difficult. Not being able to hear leads to a whole bunch of unrelated stuff, doesn't it?
Socially, it can become very difficult.
You get embarrassed about constantly asking people to repeat themselves. When you do ask them to repeat themselves and you don't hear them the second time, you're certainly not going to ask again. Mm. So you get a lot of misunderstanding, which leads to a lot of then quietness. You don't pipe up and say anything because you don't want to be brought into the conversation. It's like dropping a stone in a pond, isn't it? Yeah. These circles just keep going out. They've got nothing to do with the original stone, but they're having impacts. What impacts do you think that had on you and growing up as a younger person? My mum at least is old, quote unquote. Mm. People expect that her hearing won't be great. But when you're a teenager, nobody expects that.
Oh, you know, some of the girls used to yell at deaf head and stuff. It's like, yeah, whatever. And I probably didn't hear on the netball court a lot of the time.
You brushed that off. Was it as brushed off as you're indicating there? That must have an effect, doesn't it, on a young mind?
I just tried to disguise it so much. It wasn't until I was 40 that I accepted it.
Okay. Tell me about that. What is that?
Well, because I started my golf schools at the Victoria Golf Club, I knew I was going to be in direct contact with people. And there's a gentleman that came in who was no deal, let's put it this way, a good friend of mine from WA, and he picked up on it. And I then, from that point on, said, look, there's something I need to mention to all of you. I'm completely deaf in my right ear.
So you wouldn't tell people prior to that?
No. Okay. And I'd say, oh, look, just in case, it's not that I, you know, I'm snobbing you, I haven't heard you. So now I'm very open about that.
So if I want your attention, I throw a golf ball at you.
Yeah.
Is that how it works in your classes?
Wake up. That's right. Wake up, Jeff. It made me at ease with people because before I was trying to hide it.
Okay.
That
doesn't sound like much, but that's a big deal, isn't it? Carrying a secret around is an unpleasant way to live in many ways, isn't it?
Well, when you're young, I mean...
Was it at the forefront of your mind all the time? Was everything... Were things in life built around this knowledge that you had to deal with this not being able to hear in one ear?
I tried to sit in certain spots.
Right. It's a lot of energy to do.
I still do it now. And even, you know, when someone's catting for me, we always jog around and we move around and even at the dinner table. And I think socially, I would say, I wouldn't have as many people around. You know, when I get on a table of over six, it's just horrendous for me.
My mum says the same thing. One ear is awful for a noisy environment.
And I sit at a certain end of the table. And look, it's great now because Sam always says, now, Nandine, I'll have to sit down. It's terrible saying, I've got to actually have my own seat, you know, where I sit, because I just cannot have that conversation. But now I'm okay with it, and it just is what it is. I just have to be very protective of my other ear, because at least I would be able to have a hearing aid with that. But, you know, people probably wouldn't even give that any thought that, oh, is that why she behaved like that, or she didn't hear me, or whatever it was.
These are the things that form personality, though, don't they? And golf is a game of personality. Mm-hmm. You see people's personality in golf the way you don't see it at almost any other shared recreation.
Well, you're on a stage, aren't you, when you play golf?
Yeah, so even if you're playing off 15 in the Wednesday comp at your local golf course, yes, you are. It's a public performance.
Yep.
Absolutely. And so personality being shaped, and I'm interested in that for you and what role you think that might be playing now. You said you had this acceptance at 40, which is only 15 years ago.
Yes.
I wonder what role that's played. Is that the beginning of what we're seeing now? Is that like the Junior Golf Foundation that ends up spitting out the Adam Scott and the Aaron Baddeley? Do you see the fruits of that labour well down the track, perhaps?
Yeah, I think And I had the conversation with Mike Court a few months ago, and, you know, it's like with my left arm, you know, it had third-degree burns at the age of four.
What happened there?
I'm not stripping off, by the way.
No, I'm not sure I want to. I'm not.
Look, it's with, all the way down here as well.
I'm not good with medical stuff. Is it? Is it going to make me feel sick?
No, nothing like this right hand.
Look,
but
that's
this
awful.
Arm, I fell into boiling hot water.
What do you mean you fell into? Where?
Well, I slipped in. So Mum put the bath on.
Right.
1972 or 73 it was. And we had a tiled floor, little bath mat. And in those days, the hot water system
was hot, didn't have a regulator.
No, and so I was going to get something out of, you know, where the soap is, like a little thing out of Kallax cornflake, and I slipped and I ended up in the boiling water. And my arm and all down the left side to about midway down my leg, I was burnt. And so I had third-degree burns. The worst of it was my left arm. So they... I think Mum said they flew a specialist in from the Alfred, and my arm was in a splint.
Wow.
And they'd said that the likelihood that my arm, because when it got out of the splint, it would just go back like this because of the nerve damage. So he did a lot of physio on that. And they said, you know, there's a fair chance that you may not use that arm ever again. Whether they knew exactly and what they meant at what extent. But I
prepare for people for the worst, I think, when you're a doctor, don't you? And yeah, then and any think, other outcome is good.
And I think when you're four or five, you hear things.
Yeah,
you, maybe, you know, yeah. They think you don't hear things, but you hear things. But I think if we look at all the conversations we've been having here, Rod, I think it's more that's where my determination comes from.
Because this was the next thing I was going to. So we can see, obviously, some of the downsides, for want of a better term, the taunting about you here and living with this difficult. But what does that give? I just said this to Andrew Langford Jones, who I interviewed this morning. There's an old saying, for everything we gain, we lose something. For everything we lose, we gain something. You've lost some things with you. What have you gained, though? What do you gain from that arm injury and those physical ailments as a youngster, which is very different to having an injury later in life?
Oh, I've been fortunate enough to play golf. That's what I've got out of it. I've led a very normal life. I have travelled the world. I've met amazing people. And, you know, yes, I work every other day, but I've had a very fortunate life.
And what parts of your personality do you think have been shaped by those adversities, I think you called them earlier when we spoke?
I think I'm a very giving person. I might only have one ear. I do try to listen. My family might tell you otherwise.
Hearing and listening are two different things, Nadine.
Yes, I know. I often didn't hear them, but I'm sure I was listening. I just have a lot of gratitude. And I love other people's stories as well. I look out for a lot of other people. But this year, I've made a point of actually being kinder to myself.
Taking all those life lessons and turning them to yourself rather than others. If I came to watch you play golf, this is a sort of a difficult question to answer, possibly, but I'll try and frame it so it makes some sense. If I went to watch Jim Furyk play golf, I would describe him as gritty. If I went to watch Rory McIlroy play golf, I'd describe him as flamboyant. We might say the same things about Hogan and Seve. If I came to watch you play golf, what would I see? That's a scale, obviously.
Yeah,
you're grading
okay.
A curve there, but if you go to the extreme ends, do you understand what I'm sort of asking?
Yeah, actually,
there?
You know, and I would have said when I was younger I was very gritty, but I would say you probably look at me as being quite determined and definitely the freedom to have a go. So I don't know about comparing those two people because I bring a lot of excitement to people when they come and watch. You know, they probably see someone of my age going, oh, God, how'd they do that? How did she do that? I think it's I haven't got the word for what my golf is, and I don't think it's a flair, but I just think it's expect the unexpected.
You sound like the Jordan, give me the ball. I want the ball. I want the chance to fail.
Yeah. Give me a go.
Give me a go.
Yeah.
I heard David Faraday once describe Phil Mickelson watching him play golf was like watching a drunk chase a balloon along the edge of a cliff.
That's a great.
It's a fabulous way. And you immediately see that and you understand, don't you?
Oh.
Do you like that idea? Are you a Mickelson maybe?
Well, I do have a bit of a go and, you know, I did have someone comment that a couple of my pitch shots have been similar to Phil's this year. So coming from another golf professional, I was impressed to hear that.
Well, that's a comparison you'd like to hear, mate.
Yes,
yeah. Speaking of the golf itself, what parts of golf do you sort of enjoy the most? The physical parts? You love chipping, pitching. You like driving. What's the appeal of golf? Is it the 7-iron out of the middle of the club face, or the 2-iron back in the day when you hit one of those out of the middle of the face, or is it the funky flop shot over a bunker that finishes a foot from the hole or even in the hole maybe?
I think things have really changed in that regard. I mean, the last 12 months, I think any golfer just loves dropping a putt on someone. You just do. Hmm. I think to me that will always be it.
It's the full stop on the golf hole, isn't it?
It really is.
The golf hole ends when rattles in the cup.
Oh. And, you know, even on Sunday, look, Sam says to me the amount of times you do that. This year my putting hasn't been its best, but I've put my focus more into my driving and my irons, and I still think a flop shot or a putt to me is just, as you say, it is the full stop. It's the exclamation mark to me. It's like, I just did that.
It's interesting, we talk about the distance debate in golf and the ball going too far and how far people hit their drivers and all those sorts of things. The highlight reel at the end of this year that the PGA Tour will put out will be all short game.
Absolutely.
Every single shot will be something around the green. There'll be the odd iron that's holed from the fairway. There'll be almost no drivers.
No.
And yet, we focus almost entirely in this game, don't we, on how far we hit the ball off the tee.
Absolutely. I hear it all the time.
Yeah.
Oh, why don't you get to the States and they hit it this far and they hit it that far? And I go, okay, well, I may not be the person that hits it the furthest, but I tell you what, when you get me on the green or you get me within 70 or 80 metres, then that's when we start talking golf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. It's interesting, to go back to Peter Senior, he was on this very show, well, one of the very early episodes. I'll never forget him saying that, you know, people would always say to him, he said that he'd often played, he'd be 40 or 50 metres behind some of the other guys, which at the professional level is, well, it could be incredibly deflating.
Mm.
And I think what it does to a lot of people is it makes them try to hit it further, takes them out of their comfort zone and their game suffers. But his philosophy was, I said, how do you deal with that? And he said, well, it's pretty simple. It doesn't matter what clubs I hit. At the end of the day, there's a number on the scorecard. And if my number's 65, then somebody has to have 64 to beat me. Now, they can do it with wedges and sand. I don't care what they do it with. I'll do mine with hybrids and 5-irons. But I'm going to put up 65. So if you want to beat me, you've got to have 64.
Yeah.
That's just, and that is a mindset, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And what a great way for him to articulate that.
Yeah.
I looked at that all through the year and particularly going overseas. And, yeah, I did see some very fit people hit it 50 or 60 metres past me. But then I thought, well, hang on. Golf is just not about that one thing, and lucky it isn't. But every sport's the same, whether it be tennis or golf. The short game, to me, is the essence to a great game of golf. Yeah.
The question that led to that answer, it could easily have been, how do you win Australia's three biggest men tournaments after the age of 50? Couldn't it?
It could be.
It could be, how do you win 9 times in 15 starts as a senior women's amateur? Couldn't it?
Could be.
And it could be, how do you become the world's number one ranked senior women's amateur?
Well, as I always say to my children, you know, love what you do and have a good work ethic.
How do you feel about being ranked the world's number one senior? I've never been ranked number one at anything except number one most likely to be told to do the dishes after dinner. And I've got to tell you, that's not a ranking you want to be leading.
Oh.
How does that make you feel, in all honesty? You haven't devoted your whole life to golf, obviously, because you had that sort of 20-year break. But golf's obviously been pretty important to you, and your own play has been important to you. That's a hell of an achievement.
As I said to you, I've had the last 4 or 5 days where I've stopped, and I've actually been able to acknowledge what I've done. And I think more than anything, Rod, is the enjoyment it's brought to other people has been extraordinary. The emails, the text I get. And these are not just 20-year-old kids. I'm getting people at my golf club, at the Victoria Golf Club, and I'm getting from Traralgon Golf Club, and just all my friends all over the country. I mean, even Jackie, who I was runner-up in the British Senior Stroke Players, made contact with me since I won the Australian. I think making the friends, but watching people, it inspires them to be better, whether they play better golf or whether they go out and play golf or they just follow it. It's given them an interest.
Mm.
And to me, that has brought me joy because it's brought them something to follow. It's given them, as I said, an interest. And I didn't think at 55 so many people would be interested at the golf club as what they are. So to me, I mean, what more could you want when you've got a golf club that's actually enjoying a member doing well?
Doing well. Well, there's only one golf club in the world that can claim to have the world's number one ranked senior women's amateur. So the members of that golf club should take pride in it, shouldn't they? Because it's the only one.
Yes. And I will say to you that they were very, they were very helpful this year. Oh, we had a fundraiser there I was just very grateful. I'm very grateful to a sponsor of mine and to the golf club. But more so now, I mean, it obviously didn't pay for everything, but I just love that people are having fun with this.
Because we should talk about it or mention it. We're talking about amateur golf.
Yes.
So this is not a cheap recreation, is it?
It's exactly the same as if you're a professional golfer, but you don't get paid.
You don't get paid at all.
No.
Is that factor into decisions sometimes? Could you have made the decision not to do or make some of the trips you've made this year because of finance? You've been overseas, you've been all around Australia.
Yeah.
Nobody gives you free accommodation, nobody gives you free airfares, you don't get any of those things for free. So you're making a sacrifice, aren't you? It's a personal thing.
It's a personal thing. I mean, I had a dear friend and his company assist in America. And the fundraiser helped with part of the trip to the UK, but majority has been funded by Sam and I. And look, moving forward, there will be someone that comes forward and assists.
There'll need to be, won't there?
There will need to be.
If you're going to continue to play, you're not going to be able to afford it.
And guess what? What a wonderful story for them, because they'll probably put their name on my cap. Hopefully the other thing will continue on my shirt. And I think it's a great story for everyone because you get exposure, and some people, these companies, they're in the States, they love following it. They're all over it.
At 55 and having now achieved all this, this seems ridiculous, Nadine, but what next? You're playing the best golf of your life.
Well, I haven't reached it yet, let me tell you.
Okay, there's more to come.
Oh, there's more to come. So September, Andrew sits down with Sam and I, and we're having a drink. And this is before I went to the Victorian Senior Amateur. And he said, look, Nads, I'm calling Nads, I've got to be honest with you because you're about 60% of the way.
60?
He said, you're only 60. And I said, oh, whew, thank goodness. I thought you told me I'd already got to 100. I'd have to give up. And I think I'm probably nearly 70, 75, because from that point on that week I shot 6 under, which was a PB for me, and I rubbed it in on the men because the men were only level par for the 3 rounds.
Men, who needs?
That way the boys are always giving me a go. They're great on the singles.
Do you play much with the men?
We don't really get to. We might be in the same field, but we don't get to play with them. I mean, at the golf club, yes.
I was going to say, because what a shame in so many ways.
It's a shame. I mean, I wouldn't mind it.
Sport lends itself so easily to men and women playing together without it needing to be a competitive thing.
I mean,
thing,
we're at the same event.
It.
We could actually play,
same groups and all that.
Tees, whatever. And then have gone to play in the US Senior Amateur in Arizona to finish tied 5th and losing to the eventual winner. I still think my golf's got a fair bit to go, and I like that there's at least another 25% in the tank.
In some ways, it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks about how much you've got left over. The only important figure in all of that, it's not about what Andrew thinks your golf game, it's what you think, isn't it?
Oh, well, I know there's it's certainly untapped. And I don't want to keep saying I've got potential because, you've got to go out and use it, but there's still a couple of areas of my game that need to improve. And, one area where I really worked on this year, another area sort of I slacked off on or didn't give as much time, I should probably say, but it's always good to, what I say, reset, refresh, and have a look at the things I feel I can improve on.
Is there any part of you, Nadine, that wishes you'd discovered all of this 25, 30 years ago?
I'm the type of person that doesn't have any regrets. I wouldn't change my life for the way it's panned out. I wouldn't change not having, having children.
Did you want to be Kari Webb? 20 years ago, 30 years ago?
Well, Curry was out there when I was finishing up. Phenomenal player.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying about that. Yeah. Did you want that? Did you want to be the best player in the world?
I really did. But I just think circumstance just wouldn't allow it. And, you know, people might say, oh, but you're not as good as Kari Webb. I still think I'm fairly competitive. And
Challenger right here and now, Nadine. Challenger to a match, Kari. Sitting up there in Queensland in the sun thinking that you're the best. Yeah. Come on.
Oh, maybe I could have 3 days ago.
But you've had surgery and there we go.
No, she did actually say to one of the girls who's come out on tour, and you know, on the seniors tour, and said, you better practice, Kath, because Nads is out there practicing. She said, but no, I mean, winning is a difficult thing to do. People forget that, you know, like Kari winning as often as she did.
Making it look easy is different to a better
Oh,
easy,
absolutely. Yeah. Look, I just don't have any regrets. It is what it is. Whatever I did, and we're in now, and I'm just grateful that I'm back playing.
Yeah. No, not just back playing.
Yeah, you know.
Playing some extraordinary golf. Before we go, just on Kari, I can't think of anyone who's made a greater contribution to the game post their playing career.
She's amazing.
And just continues to give and give and give. And we continue to underappreciate her in this country terribly, I think.
You know, I'll never forget. It was probably a good 7 or 8 years ago. And she couldn't even get a sponsor. And I'm thinking, my goodness.
It was only 2 years ago she was asked to pay for clubs. She's been on this podcast. Oh. She was asked to pay for golf clubs. Now, Kari can afford to buy golf clubs. Nobody's pretending that she can't.
Honestly?
But there is no male golfer in history with a record like hers who any company rep would dare suggest they put their hand in their pocket for any golf club.
I'm embarrassed to hear that.
It's embarrassing as an industry. It really – the same thing had happened to NB Park a couple of years ago. She was told she wanted a particular 3-wood to take to the British Open. Mm-hmm. Was told, yeah, they're $180 or whatever they are. 7-time major winner. Just that. It is. It's deflating.
I'm in shock. You can hear me now, but I just cannot believe that would happen.
Not for the first time. Full credit to Mizuno Australia, who came to the party and supplied Kari, fitted her up with a bunch of golf clubs. Mm-hmm. But what a. It's sad to think that that's.
And she had so much to offer. Like, you know, when I was finishing my career, Kari was coming into golf. And I just remember being away with her and you come and have dinner and ads and all that sort of thing. And then, you know, she was heavily involved in a charity foundation that we had for Fiona Pike. And she did wonderful things there. And I just hope that, I don't want people to use her because that's not the word, but I want they to facilitate her expertise, you know, just to be involved with her in some way, like guest speaking.
She almost never says no, which is staggering for somebody in her position.
Mm.
But she agrees just through generosity to do almost everything that's asked of her to promote the game in this country and always has done.
Mm.
And I don't know that we collectively have repaid that generosity of hers.
Mm.
And I don't know whether she feels that. But
probably a very difficult thing to ask her.
Yeah, really difficult to think about too. She's at the end of the day, she's a shy kid from
she's
Queensland.
She's very shy. Yeah.
From Queensland, who's kind of made it big on the back of an extraordinary talent, which she has exploited fully and done everything. But, you know, at her very core, she's a shy kid from country Queensland.
Mm, yeah.
And so that's, you know, it's not always been a comfortable place for her to be in the spotlight, but that's not what we came together to talk about. But I think that we do undervalue. We had her on this podcast and it was fabulous. In fact, she's just done, hat tip to Bruce Devlin. What's the name of the podcast? I can't remember. They just did a 4-part series with her.
Yes.
Podcast. I think they're about an hour long, each of the episodes. Oh, wow. It was fantastic stuff. So
just keep interviewing her every day.
Yeah, kind of.
Just she's keep talking and getting into her head. And
she's a good talker. Who do you look to or have you looked for, if anybody, as inspiration yourself over time?
Probably always been external to golf. I'm not a groupie by any means. I don't hang around the right people or anything like that. Look, I just, you know, my family are probably what inspire me. I've never really looked to people that have succeeded per se.
Success is a different thing to everybody, isn't it? I mean,
how do you measure it?
Well, we have these narrow views of what success is, and all too often in our society, because it's easy, we use money.
We use money. I've always said, you know, people say, are you successful? I said, oh, yeah, I've been successful. But people want to put a monetary value to
How big's your house? How many rooms? How many cars?
How many cars you got?
How much did that cost?
Yeah, exactly.
You walked here today, Nadine.
Oh, no, I can't afford a car.
That's right.
I'm not allowed to drive at the moment.
Who needs a car? Well, I agree with you. I think you're one of the luckiest people in the world. Not only are you extraordinarily good at golf and having this wonderful second golf life, your business is chocolate.
Yes.
So it's good that you don't complain about anything because, frankly, you've got nothing to complain about, have you?
Well, don't you know that chocolate makes you feel good?
It absolutely does. And what a note to finish on, Nadine. It's been fabulous to catch up with you. Wishing you all the success for the future, but I don't think we need to. I think you're going to take care of that yourself. It'd be great to see where you go, given that you think you're only 75% of the way there. So we're going to watch with interest. But thanks for taking some time.
Thanks for having me, Ron. It's great to be here.
All that, and she reckons she's only at 75%. I can't wait to see what 2024 holds for Nadine Goal. Well, that wraps up not only episode 108, but also season 2023 of The Thing About Golf. It's been a big year, and myself and John Huggan and all the team here at Golf Australia can't thank you enough for continuing to tune in. It's a privilege to get to talk to some of the people we do on the pod, but it would ultimately be pointless if nobody listened. So take a bow and accept our heartfelt thanks. We will, of course, be back to do it all again next year, kicking off on January 17, when we'll meet a Melbourne golf stalwart who's one half of one of the most interesting golf businesses in the country.
If people want to buy some functional golf clothing that's a little bit different, we've got that, some footwear. If they want to trade their golf clubs, they can trade their golf clubs. If they want to sell golf clubs from a deceased estate or things they just don't want anymore, we'll buy them. We'll refurbish clubs for people as well.
That's Henry Cussell of Melbourne's ATT Golf, next time on The Thing About Golf.